I want to talk about using the Dharma in meditation and, of course, in daily life. I don't really see a difference between the two. I think anyone who's been practicing for a while will begin to notice that life's getting a little better in some areas. Maybe this overall stress level has gone down a bit. And maybe we're more aware of suffering as we go through our day. And there's no reason at all that we can't apply the same process that we bring to meditation to our daily lives. And I've found that driving is a great opportunity for me to use the Dharma, because my responses will illustrate many of the principles on the lists of the Dharma. To give you an idea of the tool that I'm referring to as the Dharma, I was going to bring a chart that I bought on my first long retreat at Spirit Rock. I was there for 6 weeks, and I kept finding that I wanted to know more about what was going on in my mind. And I couldn't remember the Dharma, and I hadn't brought books because they suggested that we don't. So I went down to the bookstore down the hill, and I found a chart of the entire Dharma. It's all there. I mean, I keep it in a roll, so this week I got it out and I uncurled it and it was ready to come. And I was going to hang it up. And the circle, I don't know, I guess it's about 2 to 3 feet in diameter. And it's got these rings. But I realized if I put it up here, you wouldn't be able to read it. Mm-hmm. If I passed it out, you probably would be able to read it. So I got a list of all the lists. And we'll go through them painstakingly before my Dharma talk is over. I'm kidding. But I will refer to them.
A list of lists.
A list of lists. That's what the Dharma is, because Buddha lived in a pre-literate society. Writing just hadn't quite happened yet. So for over 2 centuries, the teachings were handed down through the oral tradition. And I don't just mean people saying, oh, you know what Buddha said. They literally memorized his sermons. And they had very elaborate methods of ensuring that they got it pretty much word perfect. And some of these methods include memorizing it backwards. And they would have several people who were charged with memorizing X number of suttas. And every so often, they would all get together and compare notes. So this is how well it was preserved as an oral tradition. But one of the things that helped them remember it was, and the Buddha used this when he gave these sermons, was repetition. And when you read some of the suttas, it just makes you crazy. And the other is lists. Listing. There are 5 attributes of this and 4 things you should do about that. So the interesting thing about Buddhism, there are these major branches of it. It's, you know, like the people of the book, Judaism and Christianity and Islam. There have been all of these splintering off within Christianity. There's Greek Orthodox and Catholicism and Protestantism. There are all these splinters. Well, throughout Buddhism, they all have the lists. They might emphasize one thing over another and sharply criticize the other branches because they don't have that. But we've all got the lists. And Joseph Goldstein has a great book called One Dharma, which talks about the basic principles that all of Buddhism shares. I'd like to read a quote from Bhikkhu Bodhi, who's one of my favorite scholars of Buddhism. He says, Buddha makes suffering and release from suffering the focus of his teaching. And he deals with the problem of suffering in a way that reveals an extraordinary degree of psychological insight. Like a psychoanalyst, the Buddha traces suffering to its roots within the mind. They are craving and clinging, and Buddha holds that the cure, the solution to the problem of suffering, must also be achieved within the mind. So we're not looking to external forces or, you know, holy objects or ritual ceremonies. But since suffering arises from our own mental bad habits, we have to purify our mind of these habits from greed, hatred, and delusion or ignorance. And he says this requires profound inner honesty. And honesty is such a wonderful function. It's like an active form of love. It's accepting. It knows and accepts what is. And then to say that, to share that with another being, is a wonderful loving connection. To reflect back the truth of what is. So what we're being honest about is what's going on in our minds that makes us suffer. And we need to bring love to this because it's things that our minds are doing that causes the suffering. The root is closely associated with what we think of as ourselves. And a frontal attack will not yield good results. It'll just make us feel attacked, even if we're the entity that's doing it. So we need to bring love to this task, and acceptance and compassion. They're all different qualities of what I think of as a very deep spiritual love. And the criterion, the only goal that we have, the criterion for success, is to lessen the suffering. If it works, that's what we should be doing. In fact, the whole judgment about the Dharma is whether or not it works. It's an inside job. You know, Buddha gave us the Dharma, but Buddha's not going to relieve our suffering. He said, you yourselves must strive. The Buddha only points the way. He said, those who meditate and practice the path are freed from the bonds of death. Pretty amazing statement, because, you know, I refer to what we think of as ourself, which is so much different than our true nature. And our true nature is not what we imagine goes through the process of dying. What we imagine ourselves to be is impermanent. And it will come apart. But the part of us that is capable of this kind of love I'm talking about doesn't go through that kind of dissolution. Anyway, that's as mystical as I'm going to get tonight, I hope. Back to this pragmatism of the Dharma. You may have heard of it, a very famous sutta called the Kalama Sutta. Buddha came to a village. This was an era kind of like now, when there were a lot of spiritual teachers, a lot of doctrines that were popular. And the Kalamas, people in the Kalama village, didn't know which way to turn. Here comes Buddha, you know, another bunch of people in robes. What's your truth? And how the heck are we supposed to know which is the right one? And Buddha said, don't look to whether or not the teacher is charismatic. Just listen to what's being suggested that you try, and try it. And if it works, then that's the true Dharma. When you know for yourselves that something is wholesome and beneficial, then you should accept it and put it into practice. I was down for a half-day retreat with Gil not too long ago, and he said something that inspired me to say that tonight's Dharma talk would be about using the Dharma. And it was this flood of inspiration. I can't remember what he said. I've been racking my brains for the last couple of weeks. What was it that inspired me? And finally I realized that doesn't matter. It's what the inspiration was. And that is that we learn the Dharma kind of through osmosis, coming to sanghas, listening to Dharma talks, going out, studying on the web, or buying books, or having a friend give you. I can remember I got a little copy of the Dhammapada in my first few years, and I read that backwards and forwards. So it just kind of seeps in after a while, and eventually it becomes that huge circle that I was talking about. Maybe we don't have it all plotted out in our minds, but we've at least heard the names of the lists, like the four wise efforts or the seven factors of enlightenment or the 10 paramitas, or, you know, you don't have to know what they are, but you've heard the lists, and you know that, like, for example, patience is in there somewhere. And determination is another something good. But that maybe craving you don't really want to go for or stick with. So the stuff kind of goes in through the skin. And we can use it when we're meditating, oddly enough. It's not something that we study and then we get a term paper or a final exam and we either pass or fail. All of that stuff that we've been hearing can be applied when we're sitting in meditation. And that's the gist of what Gil said. And here is an example of a meditation that I had, perhaps unwisely, before lunch. I was sitting and I noticed that my mind was jumpy. I could bring my attention back to the breathing, but it didn't stay there for very long. And finally I said, the key question to meditation, what is this? What is going on in my experience? And the answer came to me from the Dharma. The answer was restlessness. And that comes from a list of five things, the five hindrances. I was experiencing mental restlessness. And I asked again, what's up with that? What is this? And the answer came. It came in the form of sensations in my body that I recognized primarily as hunger. It was located in the growly kind of area. And I noticed also that my mind had been flitting from the thought of one food, you know, to another. There was, you know, the salty, the savory, the sweet things. So I asked again, what is this? And again, it was restlessness. Well, okay, what's under the restlessness, I asked, which is a question that one of my teachers taught me to ask. If we are in one of the hindrances like sloth or torpor, which is the opposite of restlessness, a good question to ask is, what would I be experiencing if I weren't falling asleep? And that recognizes that the mind has a tendency to hide things from us, which is another reason why honesty and compassion is so important in this practice. So I asked this question, and the answer came back, I have aversion. I am recognizing one of the key central lists, which is the three roots of suffering, and they are greed, hatred, and delusion. Hatred is a synonym for aversion. So I was having aversion to the hunger. And I realized many years ago when I was sitting at the Forest Refuge and I was talking about desire and aversion with Joseph Goldstein, and he was suggesting that I look for desire around mealtime. I went back to him and I said, it's not there. My primary issue is aversion. I don't like being hungry, and I don't like having to eat bad food. So this restlessness and the thoughts of food were trying to distract the attention from the hunger so I wouldn't experience the aversion. And I thought, well, I'm going to bring up determination, one of the factors of enlightenment, and I'm going to turn my attention to the hunger, which was a mistake, because then my mind was flooded with aversion. I forgot a key principle, which was to do this with kindness toward myself. And the source of the suffering wasn't the hunger, it was the aversion to the hunger. So then, with compassion, I opened my awareness to that aversion, and I went into a very deep, serene concentration. And the suffering just melted away. So when we do this practice, it's not always going to have a dramatic result like that. I mean, I was just a little late for lunch, right? It wasn't a great misfortune in life that I was dealing with. But the goal of all practice is to identify whatever suffering is going on in our lives, however great or small, and to alleviate it. Because what happens is, as we recognize our suffering, as we do this practice, we get better at it, we get to know our minds, and we start to untie some of these karmic knots that form the self. We get lighter. Gill refers to this as the process of enlightenment. We're not so knotted and heavy. And as the knots that kind of make up the idea of who I am, the self, as they start to untie and we can see through the self, we're weakening the ultimate root of suffering. Because the greed and the hatred come from the ignorance of our true nature. And that, by the way, is the last of the 10 fetters. The last thing to go before complete enlightenment is the last lingering misunderstandings of the true nature. The self is empty. It's just these illusions that we've created and cling to. Now, the nub of the Dharma is in the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. I bet we've all heard of that. Four and eight, okay. Four Noble Truths, the final one, is the Eightfold Path, and that's the beginning of the Eightfold Path is the Four Noble Truths. They're totally tied together. Everything else is, it's kind of like instructions on how to unpack the self, the mental habits, if you will. It's as if all of these lists, and I've got them here, I've got the list of lists, the three characteristics of existence, impermanence, dukkha, and anatta, not self, emptiness. It's not what we think it is. Three poisons, three refuges, you've heard of those. The four Brahma Viharas, or divine abodes. Four foundations of mindfulness. The four right efforts, the five hindrances, the five precepts. Seven factors of enlightenment. 10 perfections. 10 fetters. And then here's one of eight. It's actually four pairs. I love it. You know, some of these are bringing the attention to the causes of suffering and the things we shouldn't do. And others of the lists bring our attention to comfort, how to bring joy into our lives, how to solve the problems. And I love this list because this is the stuff we can't do anything about. This is gain and loss. We get it today, it's gone tomorrow. Pleasure and pain. We feel it or we don't. Praise and blame. Well, we can look in a mirror and praise ourselves, but other people are going to do it on their own. And fame and disrepute. So I love it that, you know, there's even a list that just don't even bother about these things. Let them go. There's one other metaphor I want to bring up about all of these other lists. For example, the 10 perfections, things that we want to cultivate in ourselves. Renunciation, patience. You know, as someone who practices with driving, patience is so important. And determination. Stick to it. Go on investigating. Investigation is one of the seven factors of enlightenment. These are all things like mirrors. You know, we really don't know what we look like until we encounter a mirror. And then we only get really a two-dimensional image. But if we've got all of these different mirrors, then we get the full picture. So I think that's how I think of the lists, as they're little mirrors that let us look at the aspects of ourselves, the mental fabrications. That's from the five aggregate case. You wanted to study that one again. And what we think of ourselves are composed of all of these things. And if we can get a good look at them, then the ones that lead to the suffering lose their power. And the ones that lead to happiness do their exercises and build up strength. So at a gallop, that's how to use the Dharma. Thank you.